Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddham Dhammam Sangham Namassami. Appreciate the group enthusiasm in joining in with the Namo Tassa, but that's usually just the person who's giving the Dhamma talk. So if other people would like to give talks as well this evening, then you're welcome, but I'll talk first, all right? So it's a great delight to be here again. It's a couple of years since I was last at Abhayagiri. This evening, seeing so many familiar faces and also having become acquainted with some of the newer people here at Abhayagiri, also other people who have started coming to visit the monastery during this time. It's a great joy for me to reacquaint myself with the community and to also to get a sense for its ongoing, continuing development. Those of you who were here at the Katina Festival about 10 days ago, yes?
Yeah.
I've been in a lot of places in the last 10 days, so it's hard to keep track exactly how much time has passed. But at that time, I was saying how it was a very striking quality of being here, that all of the resident monastic community are homegrown. All of the monks and novices are people that have come into the Sangha life here at Abhayagiri. That's a rare condition in monasteries. And that it's really marvelous. From Ajahn Yaniko, who I saw kind of stumbling through the gate 13, 14 years ago, as a young dude from the coast of California, coming in to see what it's like to be a guest in a monastery, and then the others who come, Tan Kasapo, Tan Kachana, Tan Titapanyo, Tan Kovilo, Pamuto, they all arrived while I was still here, and then the whole bunch of new guys, Tan Sudiro, Tan Suhajo, and and Kantiko, Gambiro, Anagarika Doug, and Anagarika John. Even memorized the names. It's very lovely to see this whole continuing development of the monastery and the life here over this time. One of the great features of Ajahn Chah's teaching and his style of practice, and one of the most characteristic qualities that he imparted and that he taught around, was the quality of community. As any of us who've tried to live with other human beings know, it takes some work. Even if you're just living with one other person, sometimes even if you're just living with yourself, you know, it can take some work. One of the striking characteristics of Ajahn Chah's teaching was that he used community as a spiritual method, rather than just, we're all just here to meditate, but unfortunately we have to put up with each other's personalities, but never mind, just avoid each other as much as possible, go to your kuti, go to your hut and meditate. But he didn't take that kind of approach, which, has its own benefits and its own qualities, but he instead actively used the differences of character and the differences of temperament and experience and spiritual and worldly qualities that we have as human beings, and used that kind of the natural qualities of abrasion, or the way that we rub up against each other, as a teaching method, so that as we live together and we have the extroverts and the introverts, the artistic types and the engineering types, the tall and the short, the energetic and the lazy, the enthusiastic and the chronically bored. We all teach each other. We all learn from each other, and everybody belongs. So that the way that we mix together, and the way that we relate to each other's characters, each other's natures, is something that, if we are wise, it will teach us all. You know, you can have the concept of, well, in a perfect monastery, usually when you're an anagarika or you're a novice, then you think, well, when I'm the abbot of a monastery, then, you know, if I was running this monastery, then we would do it like this, we wouldn't do it like, we'd always do it this way, and we'd never do that. Yeah. You have clear, absolutely focused ideas about how it should be. And I speak from experience. And so, but in your fantasized monastery off in the future, when you're an anagarika, and you're kind of the Ajahn sitting up there in the middle with the big cushion, then around you, the monastics are these kind of brownish-coloured blobs that just say, yes, Ajahn. How can I help, Ajahn? Yeah, please don't let me ever cause you any trouble, Ajahn. That's all they ever say. They're just nebulous blobs of agreement. That are always completely in accord with your wishes. Even when your wishes change, they're still in accord with them. There was a famous photograph that was produced at Wat Pananachart one time when Ajahn Jayasaro was the abbot there, and that one of the junior monks was a bit of a dab hand at Photoshop, and they took the group photograph of the community, and he put Ajahn Jayasaro's head on the head of every single monk's body, and then put on the caption, you know, the perfect monastery. Everyone agrees with the Ajahn. This is great, you know. But life is not that way, and it's kind of a joke, but it's also kind of not a joke. And again, early on in the very earliest days of Wat Pananachart, the monastery for the Western monastic disciples of Ajahn Chah, I think just even a few months after it had opened up, and Ajahn Sumedho was trying his hand out as being the abbot at the tender age of maybe 7 or 8 reigns as a monk. He was having to lead this community, and he sort of dragged himself over to Wat Bapong to see Ajahn Chah, and all morose, and, oh, it's so difficult, Lungpo. Oh, this monks, you know, I want them to do one thing, and they keep doing the opposite, and they won't listen to me, and I'm supposed to be the Ajahn, and they won't pay any attention. And of course, Lungpo Chah just laughed in his face. Oh, Sumedho, you know, what were you thinking, Sumedho, that they were all just going to agree with you and obey all the time? You know, haven't you been watching? And he said, it's like, you know, you get all the monks to lie down, and you get all their feet to kind of line up in a nice neat row, and then all their heads are out of order. So then the heads are all uneven, okay. So you go up to the other end and you line all the heads up, and then, okay, now the heads are all in the good straight line. And, oh, damn, the feet. Yeah, you know, the feet are all out of true now. You know, that's the way they are. Some are tall, some are short. Yeah, that's how we are. We don't all line up. We're not all neat and tidy and all the same shape. We don't all have the Ajahn's head. So this abrasion that we have, if we're wise, then we use that to help us to wake up the way that the people see things differently, do things differently, understand things differently. And this little ceremony, those of you who don't have a perfect grasp of Pali might have been wondering, what the heck was all that about? You know? And even those of us who do have a bit of a grasp of Pali, you know, it's a familiar ceremony, but it's also worth understanding what that was about. So I've only been here for not quite a couple of weeks, but having lived together with this community for just even a short period of time, it's quite possible that I've caused offense and upset Lumpur Pasanno or others of the community here. And so when you have been together with others for a period of time, then you open yourself for correction. You express this, say, regret if there's something that you've done by body, speech, or mind, by one of the three doors, body, speech, or mind, that has been painful or hurtful to the elder or to the others there, then whether it's intentional or unintentional, then you ask for forgiveness, because you recognize no matter how hard you try, you're guaranteed to annoy somebody. Even the Buddha, who is like a totally enlightened being and the most sort of gloriously accomplished and noble, good-hearted person, managed to annoy a lot of people in his own time. The scriptures are replete with those who were inspired by him, but also those who were offended and upset. I think the very first Dhamma talk in the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle-length discourses, it recounts that a certain proportion of the monks who were listening to the Buddha's talk were not pleased with what he had to say. They took offense and were upset because of disagreeing or being irritated or misunderstanding what he was saying and feeling that he was speaking in an inappropriate and spiritually unhelpful way, something that was wrong and irritating, upsetting. So we annoy each other, not all the time, but some of the time. So that way of acknowledging that, even with the best of intentions, we irritate each other. I'm sure I've managed to annoy Ajahn Janiko somehow or other. Something that I've said, my obnoxiously English accent, trying to be, I have a problem with being a know-all, being kind of always having the answer for everything. I'm sure that's upsetting from time to time. Who does he think he is? Who's he trying to impress? I'm not reading your mind. Just in case you're wondering that I am, but this is all just randomly made up stuff. So. But we do annoy each other. But then by making this gesture of, say, asking for forgiveness, this is a very beautiful way. So you're consciously wiping the slate clean. So you are saying, okay, well, if there has been anything, my body, speech, or mind that's been annoying, irritating, upsetting in any way, then please forgive me. And then the elder will always say, I forgive you. And very beautifully, the custom is that you say, please forgive me also, because even if someone is regarded as a very highly accomplished person of great spiritual capacity, they will still recognize, even in the position of being a senior of many years or a high-ranking elder or teacher, that you are still capable of irritating other people. So you say, please, hang kamami tum he pime kimitabang. I forgive you, and please forgive me also, because the teacher recognizes that they will also be irritating and annoying and upsetting to other people. So that this is a beautiful way of say, wiping the slate clean and say, okay, and we can now part company and there's no unfinished business. So, of course, just holding a ceremony and repeating some words in Pali does not enable us to let go of everything, because there might be a few things that we're hanging on to. They say, well, actually, Ajahn, now you mention it, and we can find ourselves unable to forgive, or things that we want to carry around and that we can't let go of. But it's very useful to have this kind of a ceremony, because at that moment it highlights that array of things that you're still hanging on to, that you're saying the words, I forgive you, and that you realize as you say those words, well, actually I don't. There's a few things, come to mention it, that I'm hanging on to, but you're aware at that moment of the things that you're hanging on to, and that as Ajahn Chah very, very helpfully said one time, 50 or 70% of the practice of Dhamma is knowing that you should let go and not being able to. Because the part of our mind that says, let go, and let's go, is working for a different company than the one that says, not yet. They're not actually governed by the same board of directors. So that's an extraordinarily helpful and wise comment of Lungpo Cha. He recognizes, that these are working for different companies, and that our noble wisdom says, yes, let go of everything. I have no desire to wish ill of anyone. I have no malice or grudge against anyone. I feel only goodwill and compassion for other beings. But then there's also the past karma of our loves and hates and hurt feelings. And there's that kind of little knot in the heart that says, yeah, but him, never. And we need to be patient with that inability to forgive, that patient with that, say, the determination to hang on. And as Lumpu Cha was pointing to in that comment, it says 50 to 70% of the practice is knowing that you should let go and not being able to. It doesn't mean that you're justified in hanging on, but more recognizing that you send out a message: let go, and you might loosen your grip a little bit, but it takes patience and persistence and commitment to keep letting go and letting go and letting go until finally, after you get really tired of hanging on, that suddenly it just drops away on its own, that your heart feels the burden of attachment and just drops it. But that takes time, that takes application and takes patience. But this is a very useful custom, and you don't have to just do it when you come to the monastery, or you don't have to do it in Pali. It's also something that you can... I do recommend that you try it in your own homes with the people that you live with. And I remember doing this once or several times at the Spirit Rock family, the summer camp. And at the end of the family retreat, this sort of summer camp that they have there every year, between parents and children, there's something really beautiful and poignant about a 3-year-old saying to her mother, yes, I forgive you. Yeah, please forgive me also, and the mother saying to the child, yeah, please forgive me, and I forgive you too, and this way of say recognizing that we can have the best intention in the world, but we can't always please each other, but by that recognition, then that recognition of how we can rub up against each other, how we can disappoint each other, irritate each other, and acknowledging that, seeing that we are having that kind of effect on each other from time to time, and then the readiness to work with that and to learn from it and to intend not to hang on to it. This is a very, say, beautiful way of helping community to be established. You can't just say, let's have a sangha, ding! Let's have a spiritual community. I mean, there's a few people. Mendocino County is famous for its communal living and different collectives, communes, and such like. I'm sure there's a few stories of collectives that didn't stay collected, that turned from collectives to disintegratives, if such a word exists. Yeah, because with the best will in the world, it's difficult to get on with each other. So, to develop community and to cultivate community, there needs to be the part of it is a capacity to recognize our own shortcomings and to forgive the shortcomings of others. And then in that way, we're able to open up to a deeper commonality, a deeper connectedness and relatedness that we have beneath our personalities, beneath our genders, our ages, our sizes, whether we're tall or short, old or young, female or male, extrovert or introvert, artistic or mathematical, whatever the surface levels are, then it's that through that patience and forgiveness and the quality of openness to our faults that enables us to attune and to open up to that deeper reality. You can't just, let's all be one. You can't just have the idea, stick it on put it on a bumper sticker and then make it happen. It takes work, it takes effort, and this kind of quality of forgiveness and that readiness to adapt and to let go. This is, in a way, the engine of concord. That's how concord is really established in our lives. Tomorrow, Ajahn Yaniko, again featuring in this Dhamma talk, and Than Pumuto are going off on a Tudong walk. It's a long hike, setting off, I think, from Metika's place, is that right?
Yes.
Over on the coast, Fort Bragg, north end of Fort Bragg, and setting off into the Lost Coast area. And this is a part of our tradition as forest monastics. We go on these long-distance wanderings called Tudong. And the word Tudong is a Thai word, comes from the Pali Dutanga. And Dutanga literally means something like a means of shaking off. So like if you've got a kind of a sticky wrapper, like a sweet wrapper stuck on your finger, it's like, you know, you shake your hand to kind of get this sticky thing, to let go of this sticky thing. So Dutanga is something that helps us to shake off our attachments and our self-centered habits. So this kind of a long-distance wandering, we've all done a certain amount of it, some in Thailand, some in the West, other countries. So Than Yaniko, last year he made a long walk with Tanti Tapo from here up to the Pacific Hermitage, just over the Columbia River in Washington State. So he's taking Than Pumuto, just finished his fifth rains, off for a walk. And part of that custom is you might have arranged meetings with devoted lay supporters who are standing by the roadside with piles of freshly cooked and delicious food, or you might have no plan at all. Or you might have a plan, and then the devoted lay person is at junction A, and you're at you've read the map wrong, and you're at junction B. So you're patiently waiting for them, and they're patiently waiting for you in different places. So when you are on these kind of walks, I think it's an ideal opportunity to explore the nature of uncertainty. So, because even when you've made plans, I did a long walk through England about 30 years ago.
Wow.
And most of the day's food offerings were planned in some way or another, but it didn't always work out. Nowadays, more of the Tudong walks go with no planned meetings, and that the monks or nuns who walk on these journeys live completely on faith of the offerings of random strangers from the locality. So Than Yaniko, Than Pumuto, the Lost Coast, they're not even quite sure where the towns are. Lumpo Pasanna was saying that a town they thought they were going to walk through, the town is an abandoned gas station. And it appears that maybe where they didn't think there were towns, there might be small towns, but the quality of going into the unknown is very much a part of the Tudong life. And the Dutanga practices are the allowable ascetic practices that the Buddha established for his students. He didn't allow the kind of yogic self-mortification, like starving yourself completely, or standing on one leg for 40 years, or lying on beds of nails. And that this is forbidden for us, which some of us are grateful for. But he did allow just living on one meal a day. He allowed living on the food that's given to you by random strangers. He allowed just wearing just no more than three robes that you that are the only items of clothing that you use, or not lying down to sleep at night. There's 13 of these ascetic practices that generally are aimed at food, sleep, shelter, and clothing. So it kind of goes straight to the reptile brain. It's the sort of instinctual reactive areas about my stomach, my space, and my comfort. And so that it's just pushing the limits and giving you an opportunity to look at the mind's reactivity when you're not sure whether you're going to eat or you're not going to eat. You're not sure where you're going to stay. You're going to be hot. You're going to be cold. You're going to be wet. You're going to be dry. You don't know. And so it's just a very skillful array of practices that the Buddha allowed to help us push the limit and to help us, develop an insight into anicca, to uncertainty and to the unknown, not just in the comfortable, protected space of a meditation hall, but the unknown when it's pushing at the reptile brain of food, shelter, space, comfort, and so forth, sleep, that these very primal areas of the mind. That area of uncertainty or tudong is very much the hallmark of the forest monastic life, that we're called the Dutanga tradition because of the use of these practices. And so many of us have used these very actively over many years. And we know that the kind of theory of contemplating anicca, contemplating uncertainty in the comfort of your own living room is one thing. Or like we were talking about at tea, when you've got like wild animals out there, you know, bears, mountain lions, let alone tigers and cobras, and it's like the reality. Or I think Lumpur was saying about the theory of how you will relate to meeting dangerous animals. Like when you're in the safety of your kuti, when I meet a cobra, I will extend loving kindness. And, you know, if I see the eyes of a tiger shining in the night, then I, of course, will extend my heart full of metta and compassion. May you be well, may you be happy, may your hunger be abated. Somehow. But then when you actually hear the sound of that growl in the dark, something else happens. So going on tudong, and whether Ajahn Yaniko and Tampamuta will have a substantial meal tomorrow before you set off. And I suspect Metika will have her input. But then who knows? You go into the unknown. You don't know whether you're going to eat the day after, or you don't know where you're going to stay. You don't know if you're going to have shelter, or maybe that really big storm that everyone's been waiting for, that kind of week-long deluge, is going to land. Maybe it will. And so that you're walking into that uncertainty, and the reason why it's not just self-torture is that it's a deliberate choice to look at how the mind deals with the unexpected, or deals with difficulty, and so it's there's an expression that we use as a kind of motto of our Dutanga tradition, is the suffering that leads to the end of suffering. So it's rather like an extended the monastic life is rather like an extended trip to the dentist, you know. Yeah, just to really kind of talk it up and make it sound attractive for everyone. Yeah, that's the sort of put out the kind of appealing glossy brochure. You know, but the thing is that it does work, and this is the remarkable thing: is how when you turn towards that difficulty, and what might not be attractive, like eating just one meal a day, or living what is offered by random strangers, or finding what shelter you can under the root of a tree, that when you turn towards that and face it, then you can find this resources within yourself that surprise you. Many years ago, I was on a tudong walk with Lumpur Sumato, and this was in the northwest of England. We were walking through this area called the Forest of Bowland, through Lancashire and into Cumbria. And the first day, walking along the canal bank, beautiful blue skies, a few puffy white clouds, beautiful, you know, the yellow irises growing on the canal bank. Canal, you know, level path. I mean, wow, this is great. Tudong with Ajahn Sumedho, fantastic, you know. then so then day two, we kind of climb up onto this into the hills, and it was just this wall of rain coming out, like horizontal rain coming at us. Yeah, it was so dense. The only way you could find out which direction to walk in was with the compass, because you couldn't see the landscape. The rain was sort of coming in your face, and it was like that for days and days and days. I'm not kidding. I mean, I am prone to exaggeration, but it was like that. I mean, we were so wet. It's like, so after about 4 or 5 days walking through the hills like this, we got to Morecambe Bay. It's in Cumbria, the Morecambe Bay, and we're setting up camp, and everything is wet. So we had, like, going through all our luggage, we had one dry sock between three of us, and everything else was soaking wet. The tents were wet, the sleeping bags were wet, all our clothes were wet. Everything was soaking wet. And Lumpur Sumedha, if you've heard many of his Dhamma talks, you might have heard him mention this, where, yeah, everything is wet. It's like you're just soaking, you're cold. He said, I was climbing into a wet sleeping bag wearing my wet clothes on a rainy night. And then I suddenly realized, this is all right. This is actually quite okay. It's cold and it's wet, but what's wrong with that? And he found this extraordinary peace. Where if we say, you know, climbing into a wet sleeping bag on a dark night while it's raining in a wet, a dripping wet tent, and everything that you got on is wet and cold already, you think, I mean, I can feel. Like, oh man, that sounds awful. And it sounds awful, but in the actuality of it, when there's no dry thing, you know, you stop looking for the dry bit because there aren't any. Something sort of relaxes, like, well, don't look for the dry bit, because there isn't one. You know, the worst has happened, so relax. You know? he often mentioned, I've heard him mention it many times in Dhamma talks since then, this was back in 1987, this one, how there's this extraordinary peace that you find, even though it's extremely unpleasant conditions. So I'm not recommending that you go home and get the garden hose out and sort of soak your bedding just to have the climbing into a wet bed experience. But it's this is the kind of insight that arises in that sort of the Tudong world. Now, you don't need to be seeking out a particular physical difficulty. I mean, we use this process of, you know, pushing the envelope, as they say, with respect to food and sleep, shelter, clothing, personal space, because that's where our reactive patterns are strongest, right? Yeah, reptile brain, non-conceptual territory, mine. Back off. You know, even maybe this evening when you're kind of staking out your little spot, like, Ajahn's giving a talk. This is my spot. You know, I've got my little patch for the evening, and you know, someone moves your cushion like 6 inches. What? Who moved my cushion? Yeah. And that primal urges rise up. Like, it's we're all subject to these things. But one of the most helpful aspects of Dhamma practice is exactly this insight, where we meet with something that we wouldn't choose, or we would think of as being difficult or unpleasant, you know, that we would never want, and that by turning to it and receiving it, then our relationship to it changes quite radically. I remember years ago that there's this well-known set of verses that called the verses on the faith mind, the Sin Sin Ming. I said I wasn't going to speak Chinese, that was Sin Sin Ming, the verses on the, I probably got the pronunciation all wrong, but the verses on the faith mind by the third patriarch of the Chan tradition. And there's a line in that, at least in the English translation, which goes, to dwell in this reality is to be without anxiety about non-perfection. To live in this reality is to be without anxiety about non-perfection. And I'd seen that, I read and seen those verses. I carried a copy of it around with me for years. And then one day, that line just sort of jumped off the page and hit me. And I realized, but I'm always anxious about imperfection. I live there. Yeah, but it's wrong and it shouldn't be that way. And what can I do to fix it? You know, along with being a compulsive know-all, I'm also a compulsive fixer. I like to explain things and jump in and do what I can to make everything all right and make everybody happy and make everything okay. And so that is based on a kind of fretful or anxious, reactive quality. And I realized I'm always anxious about things being wrong, and I always want to make them right. And when they are right, then there's a moment of, ah. But the other 99% of the time, there's this sort of, there's this tension in the heart. And that simple statement of to dwell in this reality is to be without anxiety about non-perfection. So I kind of listened to that, and I thought, okay, let's try and make a practice out of being not anxious about the imperfect. And so I began, when anything I felt was wrong, or it shouldn't be that way, or imperfect, to see if I could just leave it alone or not create anxiety around it. And it was at first it was really, really hard just to not just being with somebody who's distressed and not try to fix them or help them, but even things like a sweet wrapper left on the ground. I would always sort of pick it up and put it, throw it in the bin. To walk past a sweet wrapper on the ground and just to leave it alone. It was physically difficult to do, but then it's like then by doing that, just to say, it's not there trying to torment you. It's just there being some rubbish that somebody's left on the ground. That's all. And to pass through that and just to see that the kind of fretfulness or tension that will be created about that, and just to leave it alone. So I found that was an extremely helpful kind of a practice. To learn how to be with the imperfect, quote unquote, and then in exactly the same way of Lumpur climbing into a wet sleeping bag on Morecambe Bay in a rainstorm, that this is actually not a problem. This is all right. That what you were thinking of as imperfect, then you realize, well, what makes it imperfect? It's just you could. If you were an artist, you're Damien Hirst, and you put a sweet wrapper down on the floor, then you could charge 30,000 quid for it. And in fact, just as I come to think of it, there's this famous, as a slight aside, this true story, allegedly. So Damien Hirst was indeed doing an art exhibition, and one of the pieces of the exhibition was a recreation of a grungy corner of his art studio. So there it is, coffee, half-finished cups of coffee, old newspapers over the floor, pots full of paintbrushes covered in drying paint, a kind of mess. One of the curators comes in the evening and thinks, oh my goodness, they've left this awful mess in the corner of the gallery. I better tidy it up because the exhibition's opening tomorrow. So this piece was priced at about £300,000 by Damien Hirst, and the curator, quite unwittingly went and tidied it all up. Screwed up the papers, threw them away, cleaned all the surfaces, made it nice and tidy, not knowing that that was a piece. So, I'm not attacking modern art or Damien Hirst, but it was somewhat ironic that, the janitor, the curator thought imperfect, and whereas the official way of labeling it was piece, this is an art piece. So this is an extraordinarily useful practice, because how many times in our day do we meet with things that we don't like? Other people on the road that we call the traffic, them, that, you know, they're in my way, they're the traffic. They're driving badly, and they shouldn't do that. They shouldn't behave like that on the road. Or the people in your family, you know, your children or your parents or your partner, or the people say things and do things that are upsetting. That you know, we feel it shouldn't be that way. This is difficult. Oh no, he's done what? Oh man, how could he do that? Yeah, you know, how many times have we told him? Again, I'm not reading anybody's mind. So. You think, how did he know? This is just random, random readouts from the human world. You know, it's often this way. So we keep meeting with the imperfect and the unwanted and what we don't like. And so, looking at the way that we react to imperfection. And to see that the mind is making a judgment, and that how we meet with what we don't like in the office or in the kitchen or on the road or in the meditation hall, we meet with things that we don't like, we don't want, we feel it shouldn't be this way. To catch the mind at that moment and see how it's framing that experience, is it shouldn't be this way. This is imperfect. It's wrong. And to restrain, I mean, I'm speaking from experience, that compulsion to jump in and try and do something about it. Now, some of us are fixers, some of us are complainers. Again, I'm not reading your mind, so, or making any kind of judgment. You know, fixing is not better than complaining, or vice versa. Some of us are complainers, some of us just switch off. You know, very good at going numb, like, I don't want to know. And we just blot it out and switch off and pretend it's not there. That we all have different tactics and different preferences. But what I discovered is that one of the most helpful, and through this developing this practice over many years now, is to meet that feeling as clearly and directly and as simply as possible. And so this is what I call mindfulness of awkward feeling. So I want to promote this as an active and very useful practice. Mindfulness of awkward feeling. When that thing happens that you really don't want, exactly what you didn't want to happen, and it's just happened. And so that's that awkward feeling. We want to do something with it. We want to get away from it. We want to explain it. We want to fix it. We want to stop feeling it. That in that moment, just to be able to recognize, this is the feeling of the presence of exactly what I didn't want to happen. Or here is something that I have no idea what I'm supposed to do with this. Here is this person who's having a meltdown in front of me, and everyone's expecting me to make him all right. That's this feeling. Or give an example. I was at Heathrow Airport about to meet Lumpur Pasanno arriving last year, I think it was. And not to go into too many gory details, but he was coming because I'd invited him to the Amaravati Katina Festival. So there I was at Heathrow Airport, getting ready, just there to meet Lumpur arriving. And another monk who felt he should have been invited to the Amaravati Katina had not been invited to the Amaravati Katina. And very, very few people have my cell phone number. Very, I do have a cell phone. I use it very rarely, and very, very few people have my number. But this particular monk did have my number. So there I am at Heathrow Airport. My phone rings. Oh, this is strange, my phone. Open my phone, and there's this extremely upset person letting me know that he felt it was really inappropriate for me to have not invited him to the Katina Festival. And so there I am in the middle of Heathrow Airport, and it was quite loud. So I'm trying to listen to this senior monk, and you know, I have a lot of respect for, but is extremely audible. The people around me, and then Lumpur's Pasno is about to arrive through the arrivals gate, and I've got this very upset senior monk on the phone, and I realize, oh, this is exactly the kind of thing I don't want to happen. This is incredibly awkward. I'd really like to be able to sort of sit down and then have a proper conversation with this monk. You know, I'm sad that he's upset, and I really wish I hadn't set things up in that way. That's unfortunate. But I can't give him my attention because I'm waiting for him. And he's about to come through the arrivals gate, and we've especially invited him. And so, oh, this is an extremely awkward moment. That's what this is. This is awkward feeling plus. And then in that moment, it was really quite marvelous because it became quite, oh, well, this is just an awkward feeling. That's what this is. And then in that moment of just naming it for what it is, then it's still awkward. You're still in the middle of the conversation and he's still coming through the arrivals. But it's okay. There's an okayness because you recognize, oh, this is a feeling. It comes into being, it does its thing, it passes away. It's just a feeling. Huh. And there's a way in which there's a spaciousness around that. There's a letting go of it. There's a non-entanglement, a non-identification with that. It's recognizing, oh, this is a feeling. So I strongly recommend the development, mindfulness of awkward feeling. And it doesn't mean being passive. It doesn't mean doing anything. You're still in the middle of the conversation. You still got to pay the debt. You say, ah, yeah, I've got this $100,000 debt. This is an awkward feeling. I've got this debt. I'll just be mindful of the feeling and forget the debt. You know? No, that won't work. Well, it might work for you, but it won't work for the debtee. So no, the debts are still there. But to know it as a feeling, it transforms the whole way we relate to it, and you realize that sense of wrongness is always relative. It's dependent. It's something that the mind conjures into being, just like Damien Hirst's art piece, you know, £300,000 art piece. You know, it was named as an art piece, or somebody else named it rubbish. Yeah, we name things. We determine things into existence, and so that recognition of, oh, this is what my mind is doing. It's absorbing into this and it's feeling it shouldn't be this way. I've got to get away from this. I've got to fix this. I've got to solve it. I've got to explain it. I've got to quell this, or I've got to complete this. Those are the mind's creations. And to just catch that name, that quality of reaction, and to let go. And to say this is awkward feeling, that's what this is, then you're able to be with that moment and realize it's perfect just as it is. It doesn't mean being passive. It means that you are recognizing that there is a reactive pattern going on in the mind. But that which knows the reaction is not the reaction. It's not bound to it. It's not limited by that. And you find a flexibility and an adaptability. You find resources within yourself that you didn't know were there. Like Lumpur Sumedho climbing into a wet sleeping bag in Morecambe Bay on a dark and rainy night. Oh, who would have thought it? This is fine. Huh. And when we find that adaptability within ourselves, then this is the greatest richness, the greatest resource for us, because then really nothing can go wrong. Whatever circumstances take shape in our life, with physical illness or pain or social rejection or our business collapsing or everybody, you know, ignoring us and hating us, oh, well, I was a popular person last week. Now everyone's avoiding me. Okay, this is a this is a feeling. And then we're able to find a great peace, an extraordinary strength and peace in that adaptability. So I think there's enough in the way of reflections for this evening, and I'm very delighted to see you all. And please come and visit Amravati in England. It's only a plane ride away, just San Francisco, SFO, get on the plane. Amravati is only about an hour from the airport. If the traffic is heavy, hour and a half. It's very easy to do. So you're all invited. We've got plenty of accommodation there, and so please do feel we warmly welcomed if you can get across the pond, as they call it. And I just would like to express my great gratitude to Lompo Pasanno for carrying the torch here. I had no doubt that the good ship Abhayagiri would keep on sailing when I left the ship and went over to England. But it is really extraordinarily heartwarming to see how the community and the life here continues to develop and be a great resource and a source of blessings for so many people. So I express my great gratitude and look after Lumpur, because the days and nights are relentlessly passing. And he's speaking of valuable resources. But there's only one of these, so take care of him. And also encourage you all in your own spiritual practices, whether you're an old timer and you've been around for decades, or whether this is your first evening doing anything Buddhist. Then please do use these resources that are available, because they can bring great blessings and great joy, great peace into our lives. And so please make use of that. Mendocino is a wonderful environment, rich in many, many respects, and it's rich in Dharma life. So please make hay while the sun shines. Hay, not other kinds of grass. You know.
Dhammaya dhammakataya sadhu karangadamase.